Barry Lynn, Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
I want to ask you some things about the organization, but I have two sort of broad questions that I want to ask you first. And I'm going to tell you what most questions are so you can play. The first question I want to ask is, where did the idea of separation of church and state come from, and what is it initially designed to protect? And then the second question I'm going to ask you is, why is that important today? What's important about separation of church and state? Big issues. So my first question for you is, where did the idea of this separation come from?
As more and more people came from Europe to what was to become the United States, one of the things they wanted to avoid was any hint that the state would be supporting some religions over others, or all religions over no religion. They wanted the government to be strictly neutral. In the colonial period, some people thought that that was a great idea, like Roger Williams, who wanted a clear separation between church and state. Others in the colonial period thought, you know, we can live with a state church. It's just for us, and we're kind of all the same anyway, and we'll just sit around and have a state church. When it came to writing the Constitution, though, people said, this new government, this federal government, should be completely neutral on matters of religion, and that there should be no laws in any way touching upon religion. And the framers of the Constitution, the thinkers behind it, were very clear about this. Thomas Jefferson would not declare days of prayer and thanksgiving. James Madison even objected to counting the number of clergy in the country during the 1790 census. These are pretty powerful, some would say extreme views, but they reflected the sense that the best thing for both religion and government was to keep a decent distance between the agencies of each one.
So why does this, ask this a different way, how does that ideology from 200 and X number of years ago now, 220-something. How does that ideology work today, and why does it continue to be so important that there's actually an organization that carries that name?
To me, the heart of the preservation of the separation of church and state is the preservation of individual conscience. It means that governments at any level should not be forcing any of us to think in ways we wouldn't think, or to act in ways around our own decisions that they happen to believe is correct. I think the heart of the matter is freedom of conscience. We can't have government get in the business of telling us how to live our lives, and particularly how to live our spiritual lives. This is something that is forbidden by the Constitution and just as necessary today. No one in the United States should feel like a second-class citizen because her or his religion is different from that of the majority. No one should feel like an outcast because the religious majority says one thing and he or she thinks something else.
As a, I'm interested as an ordained minister, how does this then square with your, how does this idea of separation of church and state actually square with somebody who on a certain level represents the church?
You know, I've just never felt at any time in my life as a minister or pastor that I needed the affirmation of the state. I didn't need the government to bless what I was doing or approve of it, because I feel confident enough that I'm on the right track without having any official tell me I am. And I think many people would recognize from world history and occasionally from U.S. history the dangers of commingling church and state. You end up destroying the integrity of the faith, and you end up giving government a job they can't possibly do, sorting out theological matters. They can barely deliver the mail.
Can you give me a couple examples of real situations where people's rights are being infringed upon by people who support a different ideology than that?
One of the problems recently is this president's so-called faith-based initiative, where he's trying to get partnerships between religious organizations and government funding to do good in the community. In theory, this sounds like a great idea, but we've found consistently that people who receive these federal dollars will often try to take some of the most vulnerable people, the poorest people in America, and try to convert them as a way of guaranteeing that they will not just get the food, the shelter, but they'll get a religious conversion at the same time. Government's business is not to save souls, in spite of the president's comment once in a speech in New Orleans where he said, our job is to fund organizations that save Americans one soul at a time. Agencies without government help or hindrance can try to do that. Once you have government funding of these ministries, the moral, the legal calculus changes, and they should not be in the business of trying to bring religious truth to the people along with a cup of soup.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the work that the organization does? What kinds of things are you involved in, and how are you active?
We're very heavily engaged in preserving the integrity and quality of America's public schools. We don't like the idea of school vouchers or other things that tend to divert scarce resources away from public education into private, usually private, wealthy, and exclusive religious schools. We're also concerned about the flip side of that, how so-called religious right groups will try to influence the curriculum, try to remove evolution from the curriculum and replace it with something called intelligent design, a not intelligent and not scientific approach to just figuring out how many glorious species we have and how they got there. We're also strong opponents of the president's faith-based initiative. We're also very concerned about the politicizing of the pulpit. That is to say, where religious organizations literally endorse or oppose candidates from the pulpit in order to gain political clout for their own congregations and in order to achieve, they think, some kind of political agenda of their own. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, spoke about peace and justice almost every day of his adult life, and he did a lot of that speaking in synagogues and temples and churches. He never once endorsed a candidate from the pulpit because he did not feel that that was the appropriate venue for talking about crass partisan politics. So my suggestion to church leaders, speak about the moral issues. We expect you to do that, but we don't expect you to become a cog in any partisan political campaign.
I'm interested as a pastor. You mentioned that word before. I think that's a very powerful word. How does the idea of the separation of church and state, which I perceive to be a political idea at some level, but how does that speak to people spiritually, if I can ask that? Where does that come from, and what does that do for somebody's spirit?
Well, to the extent that people believe there's a scriptural basis for the separation of church and state, and to some degree there is, we know this about Jesus. We know that he was not interested in seeing public proclamations of prayer. He was more suggestive of going into the closet, he said, and praying to your Father there in the hopes that you would achieve what you're praying for. This public display of religion bothered him a lot more than any public display of affection, because he talks about it on a regular basis. He did not like hypocrites. He did not like posturers, people who thought, if I look religious, people will think I am and they'll think I'm a better person. Sadly, the mere fact that you're religious doesn't make you a more moral person. It might be the framework out of which you become a better and more ethical person, or it may just turn out to be a facade that guarantees nothing about your conduct or the way you act.
When you look around you in society here in the United States, where do you see the posturing coming from today? Who are the posturers?
There's a lot of posturing that goes on, particularly in the religious right. I mean, I am deeply offended, and I think we should, as pastors, make comments about people like Pat Roberts. And when he says that Ariel Sharon's stroke was probably caused because he misread the book of Joel and did the wrong thing politically in Gaza. When Jerry Falwell says that civil libertarians and feminists caused God to lift the curtain of protection on America in 9/11 and give us, in Falwell's words, what we probably deserved. That deserved more of a rebuke from mainline denominations and religious leaders, frankly, than it got. I think that when George Bush decides, after hearing that the late Pope John Paul II opposed the invasion of Iraq and said that American officials who made the decision would have to answer directly to God, George Bush brought in a set of his own theologians from the so-called religious right. They reevaluated just war doctrine, came out and held a press conference and said, "We think it's a fine idea. You can go to Iraq." I think if the president had spent a little more time looking at intelligence data and less time thinking about how to protect his theological behind, we'd have thousands more live Iraqis and Americans today. So when you decide that you're going to cover your interests by finding a proof text in the Bible or finding one group of ministers who will support you, it can have disastrous consequences on public policy and on real people.
I have one more question, and then I may do you have some things that you're thinking of that you might want to go? Okay, good. I'd like to just do this sort of vis-a-vis crosswalk a little bit. And, you know, this is a group of people who walk from Phoenix to Washington, D.C. It's very grassroots. Separation of church and state is part of what they're about, one of 12, essentially. But can you talk to me a little bit about how movements like that, or how a group of people like that, can maybe affect change? I mean, what can be learned from what these people did? And I'd like to just make that specific to Crosswalk and what these folks have done, if you can do that.
In an experience like Crosswalk, you have people who are talking to people throughout America, throughout the smallest towns, the biggest cities, and really connecting them, not just with issues of separation of church and state, but of human rights and of peace and of economic justice in a very direct and personal way. We often find on separation of church and state issues that we change the most minds when we are in a small community that perhaps is initially hostile to what we believe, but over the course of weeks or months, say, of a lawsuit, they get so much interest in people talking about these issues, appearing on television, writing op-eds. Finally, an educational process goes on. And the first step is to say, look, even if we still don't agree with those people, we understand them more. That's a pretty powerful and important step. And then frequently say, you know, thinking about it and how it affects our local community, I actually think those people are right. I've never been in the business of converting everyone to seeing things my way, which is unfortunately what some of the other folks on the other side increasingly do, continue to do. But I am interested in making sure that people know that the word of progressive Christians is not a word that comes out of a dream. It's not something we picked up from the Democratic National Committee platform, but these are deep and abiding spiritual beliefs that we want to play out in our daily lives. Progressive Christians have principles. When you add those to constitutional principles, you have a very strong dual backbone to stand up, be heard for the things you believe in.
Thank you. You know, I'm thinking there is one other thing I'd like to ask.
Okay.
That is, excuse me, is there, in your opinion, a historical context for Christians all the way back 2000 and however many years now, working together with people of other faiths and doing that in a constructive way that sort of elevates, I guess, all the parties involved? Has that happened before?
I think as a practical matter, Christians working with non-Christians and even with non-believers in any religious tradition has always happened. But there's always also been a strain of people who say, there's one way, it's my way, you get on my highway, or we don't work with you. And I think that's the attitude that has been terribly difficult to overcome even to this hour in this day. There are still people who simply will not stand next to a person of a different faith to even have a prayer, because they assume somehow they're praying to a different God. It makes it impossible to do interfaith activities or cross-philosophical activities. I think most of us who are not biblical literalists do understand that the God we believe in speaks in different ways to different people, and always has, and has never stopped speaking.
Thank you.
My question is this.
I'll just have a seat there. I'll...
Yeah, so my head is at the right position. Okay.
One of the things that I have observed in talking with people before and after this walk and talking about what we're doing, it seems to me that people see some cultural crises happening in our country, and they are being fed misinformation that our country was set up so that we could combine church and state, and if we don't have prayer in school and so forth, then we're not doing anything to solve what I think there are symptoms out there that bother a lot of us. I think we see a lot of similar symptoms, we just see very different answers. So I'm curious what your comment is about that, and what we can do to educate people about the real facts around how our country was established and what the true history is.
The historical record is very clear that this was not set up as a Christian nation. And in fact, early leaders, Washington, Adams, early Congresses would put into things like a treaty with Tripoli that this was in no way founded as a Christian nation, in order to be able to say, we can work with you, we can work with people who are Muslim, we understand that there are differences of opinion about this, and this country isn't here to promote one. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation about the Christian nation idea, and a lot of confusion about how government is somehow necessary in order to help religion. I always tell people, if government comes to help your religion, you start running in the opposite direction as quickly as possible, because there is nothing worse than to see governments try to help us and usually degrade what we're doing in the first place. It's a great temptation on the left, on the right. Let's get with the celebrities. Let's get with the politicians. But frankly, that's not where most of the truth lies. Most of the truth lies with the people. The people in those churches, the people that are walking with you, the people you encounter along the road. Rarely do you get great wisdom, I'm sad to say, from people on Capitol Hill.
Thank you.
We have time for two questions.
Oh, sure,
okay,
sure.
Great,
sure.
One is kind of going along that line there was an interesting situation in Morgantown, West Virginia, where there was a picture of Jesus up on the president's office, the principal's office,
right.
And then a big lawsuit, about that, of course. One of the part of the emotion we heard from the right, of course, is they're taking Jesus from the schools, and that's a pretty emotional thing. Oh my God, they're taking Jesus out. What is the best we encounter all these things intellectually, but emotionally, what's at the core of this, the other side of this?
We are representing the plaintiffs in the case involving the Jesus portraits in West Virginia. And one of the most interesting things I've heard about that was from a caller to a West Virginia call-in radio show, calling from Morgantown, and who said, it's hard enough being a religious minority in this state. Why do we have to feel, and she said, I'm a Christian, but why do we have to make those people feel even worse by putting a Christian picture up that they have to see every single day? She got it. She understands that it's as much a civil rights issue to preserve the conscience and the rights of minority students as it is to protect those of racial minorities or those of gender. I just blanked on what I was saying here, didn't I? Yes, I did. preserving the civil rights of Americans based on religion is just as important as preserving the civil rights based on race or gender or sexual orientation. This is a civil rights issue, and I think the more that we connect it to that, the more that we show that this affects real people, that the very fact that people in West Virginia were so upset that the picture might be taken down shows how powerful that image is, shows how extraordinarily important it is. And I think we have to respect the fact that people who don't accept Jesus see it also as a powerful symbol, but frankly, one with which they cannot agree.
What would be the toughest, what's the toughest argument that you encounter for that the other side will launch for merging? What's the hardest one?
Perhaps the hardest argument is when people say, if no one's doing something, going into prisons, and the state's willing to pay a religious ministry to do it, I mean, isn't that better than nothing? And sadly, in a way, this flips the question, asks it the wrong way. We have to ask the question, why aren't we, the people, demanding that prisons do two things? Number one, guarantee to people, religiously motivated or not, a job when they get out of prison. Counseling, the ability to have a chance not to become a recidivist by learning something while you're incarcerated. And then why do we make it so difficult for people who want to come in voluntarily, don't expect any money, to serve as chaplains, not just for Christians, but for Jews and Native Americans? So frequently we find ourselves fighting prisons to keep them from paying ministers to come in, and at the same time fighting to allow them to allow more ministers and other religious leaders to come in voluntarily. We shouldn't be having either fight. We should have a system that understands that if you're going to make a difference in the lives of people in prisons, then, and spirituality is something they choose, you have to help them get it voluntarily, just like the rest of us.
You know, usually, Eric, you can just say that, but there are always two things I do at the end. One of them is I'll ask you to give us permission to use this. But,
sure.
But the penultimate thing that I do is ask you to, if there's anything you feel like we missed, there's anything that you think is important that needs to be said.
This pretty thoroughly covered kind of what we do and how it connects to some of what you do. I don't think there's anything missing here, really.
Can I throw one?
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
Do you have any thoughts on how our two groups can work together to solve the problems that you are facing using, you know, people from across religious backgrounds,
sure,
across political backgrounds to get separation of church and state?
I believe it's possible to really have partnerships between organizations. They don't have to agree or have exactly the same agenda or exactly the same focus. But one of the problems with progressive movements in this country in the last 50 years is that we've tended to break apart into even smaller groups instead of trying to combine efforts to make a difference. If this was a country that took seriously as a constitutional or legal obligation protecting the civil rights of the people, we wouldn't have to be doing so much of that as private organizations. And that would be a good thing. Maybe we'd reach a society someday when people like us could simply go fishing more and appear on cable television less.
Great, thank you very much.
Okay, and you do have permission to use any or all of this material. Or to put a bag over my head through use of Photoshop or its equivalent in video.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not for you, for me.
Oh, no, it's...